Good morning.
There's little that can be said about pure space. There's really very little that can be said about pure space. But what I will communicate is something very simple. Something very, very simple. And I'll start by telling you a story about something that happened to me when I was in seventh grade. So I was about 12 years old at the time. And I was in a science class, and I had a very good science teacher, and he assigned a question to us, and it was, how is it that everything is moving? So that was our question. We had to answer this question. We had to go home and answer the question. And so we all went home and we answered the question and came back, and he had his correct answer. His correct answer was that the earth is always moving. It's always rotating. Thus everything on the earth is moving because the earth is always rotating. But that wasn't the answer I had. The answer, I had learned about molecules, and that fascinated me. So I said, well, you know, all these molecules, they're moving all the time, and everything is made up of molecules, no matter how vast or how small. So these molecules, they're moving all the time. But what's really interesting is that these molecules are just space. They're just space. They're contained within space, but they're also space, because if molecules are broken down into subatomic particles, pretty soon all we find is space. So this was fascinating to me, that there could be this reality that described everything. That was all I knew about it. I didn't know anything more about it. I didn't know it as the reality of all being or anything at all like that. But this alone is the reality of all being, pure space and nothing else. And for us as human beings, it's very important and it's most essential because it's the reality of our being, pure space. But you see, this pure space that I had become acquainted with in that moment in a direct way through intellectual understanding was not a personal experience of mine at the time that I could identify or that I had full evidence of. And nor did I have any indwelling confidence whatsoever about it being the reality of my personal being, the essence of my being, the ground of my being. All I knew is that there is pure space, and that's what everything is, and that all the molecules or the seeming goings-on are part of that space, and that the changing and the unchanging are not two. Do you see what I'm saying? The changing and the unchanging are not two. So the usual way of looking at things would be to say that the changing is one thing and the unchanging is its polar opposite. But indeed, the changing and the unchanging are two. And this is a key point about the non-duality of pure space. And that key point is that pure space is inseparable. It can't be separated into two things. The other thing that was very important about that realization is that it was only in awareness, my awareness of it, that it was. So this realization of pure space that's entirely undivided is inseparable from awareness. Without awareness, the space would not be, the pure space would not be. So the realization of ourselves as pure space is, we would not have it unless there was awareness of it. And so, you know, when I expressed this to my teacher, he loved it. He totally loved it. He said, this is great. He said, you're so smart, we're going to put you in a gifted program. And he said, but you know what the most important thing is about being gifted? He said, the most important thing about being gifted is that it means you need to help other people. So you're going to be a spelling tutor now. So this is what he told me. So you see, I learned three very important things: pure space, inseparable from awareness, and inseparable from compassion, benefit for the whole. This was very important. He was a very, very wise man and one of my most important teachers. So, you know, this is something that I found compelling all of my life, even though it took a number of years, about 20 more years, for it to become my direct experience in terms of it being fully evident as my direct experience as a living human being. And that also the indwelling confidence of it was always present, the certainty that is not only who I am, but what everyone is. So, you know, another way to kind of look at this is big me and little me. But, you know, with no personal me. There's neither a personal me nor an impersonal me. So to call it either thing would be just to engage in the folly of intellectual speculation and representational thought, because the big me and the little me are inseparable. So pure awareness as a human being, those two things are inseparable. Without the human being, pure awareness would not be. There'd be no awareness of it. So this is the reality of a human life, that we are self-knowing awareness. And so as long as we take ourselves to be the little me, so to speak, we're just playing around with all the molecules. We think we're a molecule, and somehow we're a bigger molecule than the other molecules, and we can somehow confine all those molecules and make them into an identity for ourselves. But if we spend our whole life only looking at the part that's always changing in life, then we never see the inseparability of these two. First of all, we never see that there is something that's unchanging, substantive, and the only origin or substance of anything going on within it. And we never see that we are that. You know, we never see that we are that, and we never see the inseparability of the two. So we never see the inseparability of the changing and unchanging. That is so far beyond little me that little me can't even comprehend it. But you see, many times this little me in teachings of non-duality is taken to be something. It's taken to be a personal identity. And this is very key, because if there is a personal identity that's attributed as being real in a teaching of non-duality, it's a teaching of duality. It's as simple as that, because you see, the absolute and the relative are inseparable, just as the unchanging and the changing are inseparable. And in the same way, samsara and nirvana are inseparable. In the same way, illusion or maya and satchit ananda are inseparable. So these are not two things, one thing impure and the other pure, but the inseparability of the impure and the pure, so to speak. Where the pure is, the impure is, and where the impure is, the pure is. Everything is contained in everything. This is the meaning of non-duality, a single non-dual expanse, inseparable. Just like the heat of the sun is inseparable from the sun, or the warmth of a roaring fire is inseparable from that fire. So all of these things that somehow are taken to be two many times, they're never two. So if we address them as two, what we're doing is looking for some kind of cause in the world of the changing that can somehow give us a taste of the unchanging. Well, that's just, we'll be looking forever. You know, we'll be seeking forever. So my primary suggestion is call off the search. Stop seeking. Stop seeking. Why seek what already is? Why seek what already is? What already is more obvious than anything. Completely real, already accomplished, and that has to be the starting point. So the starting point of the Great Freedom Teaching is direct introduction to the experience of the emptiness of all things. So all things, by their very nature, are empty of an independent origin. The direct experience of that, not just an intellectual understanding, but a direct experience of it that is unfaltering. That means from then on, it's completely available to us as our place to rest naturally. The reality of our being, the essence of our being, in which and as which we can rest naturally. So then you see the little me, so to speak, takes comfort in the big me. It finds its complete ease in the big me, rather than taking ourselves to be a personal identity that's all caught up in all of its points of view. We realize that we are vast as infinite space. We're completely vast as infinite space. We've never been separated out from infinite space into a little me. That never occurred. That never occurred. What always is about us. It's unerringly always what is about us. It's relentlessly what always is about us, and that can never be altered or changed in any way. The everything that we might take ourselves to be, and this is very key too, what we take ourselves to be is what we are. Now that sounds self-evident, doesn't it? What we take ourselves to be is what we are. Well, of course. Can't you think of anything better than that? But few of us look into that with great specificity. Few of us really look into that with great specificity. What all the accumulated points of view that have appeared within this pure view of awareness during our lifetime, most of us take ourselves to be those points of view, or you know, the subatomic particle level of what reality is. We take ourselves to be those points of view, that we are somebody. We're a somebody, and that somebody was born, and now it's living, and it will die. So it is somebody who has an origin, a duration, and a cessation. And that within that birth, life, and death, there occur three primary states, waking, dreaming, and sleeping. And that we are constantly at the effect of these six things: birth, life, and death, waking, dreaming, and sleeping. And of course, all of that is ruled by the two super constructs of time and space, so, and cause and effect. So time and space, cause and effect, are the super constructs that rule birth, life, and death, waking, dreaming, and sleeping. So these are all things simply that we've taken ourselves to be. We've already definitively concluded that we are pure space, which is entirely aware and compassionately outpouring, the emanation of benefit. But when we take ourselves to be limited by all these other things, then what we've done is we've taken to be that which is without limit and restriction as having limit and restriction. We say, well, yeah, everyone else says that I'm limited by birth, life, and death, waking, dreaming, and sleeping, time and space, cause and effect, so it must be true. I am, and that's what I take myself to be. When we take ourselves to be that, then we live our whole life as that. We don't know anything else. We don't even have a clue most of the time that anything else can possibly be. And most of the time for us, if we hear that there's something called enlightenment that is some kind of grand way of being, it seems so separate from anything that we're currently involved in that it just seems, first of all, unreachable and unlikely that we'll ever get there. And of course, we're told that too. And secondly, like we must have to engage in a heroic effort to be that. You know, no matter how how hard we've had to work for anything else in our life, just to go through grammar school, for instance. That was hard work, wasn't it? Grammar school. It's amazing any of us got out. But here we all sit today. We made it alive. We made it through grammar school. And some of us, maybe something after that. Well, you know, then it, when it comes to enlightenment, we think, oh, well, I'm really going to have to pull out the heroic stops on this one. You know, even if I'm a nuclear physicist and neurosurgeon combined, I'm going to have to go way beyond that to get enlightened. So because we've lived our entire life taking ourselves to be someone who's limited by time and space, cause and effect, we assume, another point of view, we assume that enlightenment will come about in time and space and through cause and effect. And so we pour all of our efforts into some kind of cause and effect relationship. Many different causes that will lead to the effect of enlightenment. And if we start out that way, we'll probably take our last breath that way. We'll still be looking for enlightenment. It'll only be with our last breath that we really call off the search. Because see, when we take our last breath, whew, then we are who we are, you know. There's no more taking ourselves to be anybody. No matter how hard we're trying at that moment to take ourselves to be somebody, it won't be able to persist. So you see, in our last breath of life, what we do is we totally relax, probably for the first time in our life. You know, we come out screaming when we're born, ah! And most of us really, even if we put on a happy face at times during life, we're always screaming inside from that moment on. You know, that first wail, we're hollering inside all of our lives. Isn't it the truth? No matter how much we try to quiet that down. So you see, with our last breath, then we go, oh, wow, I can finally relax. This is good. This is really good. Don't have to take myself to be anybody anymore. But you see, this is a very important teaching because that's all we have to do right now, die. You know, just completely relax. Completely relax and know that the essence of our being already is. No matter what we've taken ourselves to be, when that perception arises, just, whew, I don't have to go there. You know, I don't have to get into that. Where did I learn that anyway? And so, you know, this is very important. There is no personal identity to get out of the way. There is only pure space, the pure view, inclusive of all points of view. And the points of view are entirely inseparable from the pure view. Entirely inseparable. All the contents of pure awareness are inseparable from it. As all the contents, no matter what they are included and contained within pure awareness, subsumed within awareness, what else would they be, you know? What else would they be? And we can even prove this scientifically today, clearly, that everything is pure space. There's never been an observer observing something. For a long time, science was based on an observer observing something, and in that observation of something, that something would be shown to exist by the observer. But then Heisenberg came along and he said, oh no, you know, there aren't any things. There's only the observer, and the things exist only because of the observer or witness. But now, boom, that's all gone. You know? And in theoretical physics, it's being postulated that there's no observer either. So there's just pure space. But you see, all this is like pointing at the moon. We know all these things, but what good does it do us in human life? How can we really get down to business with knowing that this is our reality? Because see, anything that we're aware of, it's our reality already. It wouldn't be without our awareness. So our awareness, this awareness that is inseparable from pure space, is the primary or the constant in everything. That's how we can prove to ourselves that this pure awareness, vast as infinite space, is the reality of every single perception. That perception would not be without the awareness. So this is very straightforward. And the awareness is an awareness over here, observing a perception over here. It's awareness as the perception. The perceiver has never existed. So if we start our spiritual practice, or whatever we call it, with the idea that there is a perceiver that we need to get out of the way, then we're going to spend our whole life focusing more and more on that perceiver, which is what we've already been doing anyway. But this perceiver, this point of view of a perceiver, is equal to any other point of view. It's just a point of view. And its appearance is only obvious when it's obvious. So this point of view of being a perceiver or being somebody is something we rarely have. It's something we rarely have. Very rarely do we have the point of view, I am somebody. I really am somebody. What's your name?
Tom.
Very rarely do you have the perception or the point of view, I'm Tom. Yeah, I'm Tom, all right. You don't need that in order to live a day of existence, do you? I'm Tom, I'm Tom, I'm Tom. It's the only reason anything's going on. Tom's here, you know. So we have many of these things that are assumptions, but even if we call it an assumption, it's just a point of view. There is no storehouse, warehouse, container, supercomputer, hard drive of point of view other than awareness. So there's no personal identity, intellect, ego, psychological state or intellectual state or even mind that is anything other than a point of view. All of these constructs, no matter what they are fictions of point of view. That's all they are. So when we introduce ourselves to the reality of what we are, it's very important to come to this definitive understanding up front that we already are who we are. This has to be the foundation of living life and our spiritual practice. Otherwise, we'll spend all of our life chasing our tail. You know, like a little puppy dog chases its tail. The puppy dog never gets the tail. So you see, if we start from a false premise, then it's unlikely that we'll ever realize what it is we want to realize. Because what we are, we already are. We already are that conclusively. We don't have to do anything to prove it or to get it. When we place ourselves in circumstances for spiritual practice, where we're being told that there is somebody who needs to change or be gotten out of the way in order to realize this pristine reality of what we are. It's like being in a pond that has sediment all over the bottom and stirring it with a stick and saying we're attempting to make the pond clear. You know, we're just in there, we're stirring it with a stick and we're saying, well, gosh, I wonder why the pond isn't getting clear. Better stir some more. So we keep stirring. The more we stir, the muddier the pond gets. But if we just stop, come to a complete stop and stand there, everything settles down. The sediment settles in and of itself, the points of view settle in and of themselves, and the pristine clarity, the limpid clarity, the crystal clearness of the pond becomes obvious. So this is the key to spiritual practice, to rest naturally without seeking anything. And to rest naturally, if this doesn't come to you right away and become more and more obvious as the reality of your being, which does happen for some people who come here to the Great Freedom Teaching, then rest naturally for short moments many times until it becomes permanent. And all that means is that when a point of view comes up, just rest rather than making a story out of it, rather than elaborating on it, rather than continuing the fiction of an existence that neither exists nor doesn't. Know yourself as you are, the big me rather than the little me. So, you know, this is kind of a mundane way of talking about it, big me and little me, but I think you all understand what I'm saying. When, say, we take a functioning of our body, like body, speech, and mind, and we've already arrived at the conclusion that these are all points of view. So these are all points of view appearing within our awareness. And whatever we take that body, speech, and mind to be, it will be. So if we take that body, speech, and mind to be completely ruled by birth, life, and death, waking, dreaming, and sleeping, time and space and cause and effect, then our body, speech, and mind will be completely ruled by those things. We'll think that everything in our mind is based upon a time-based sequence of events that have a space-time dimension to them and that are completely controlled by that. And we'll believe that our body, speech, and mind operate entirely within the realm of cause and effect. And so when we take ourselves to be that, then we're a little me. we're still the big me, but we just don't realize big me is there. We don't realize all the while that this body, speech, and mind that we take ourselves to be and that we assume is located within a skin line, housed there, contained there, and can never get out of there until we die. We take ourselves to be that. But when we relax and realize either suddenly or gradually more and more about this vast reality of the essence of our being, we realize that our body, speech, and mind, too, have never been controlled or contained by a skin line. Our body, speech, and mind are also without limit and restriction. They've never been confined by anything, not by any idea, no matter how good it is. So then when we're sitting back in our easy chair and looking at things, they look a lot different. You know, all our belief systems and assumptions, all of our points of view look a great deal different. Because from that pristine vantage that's totally clear in its own place, there are no rules or regulations about awareness. None. You know, the idea of anyone owning awareness or owning the right to awareness or being able to control awareness and dish it out to people becomes absurd. You know, we already are who we are. Who would be the owner of enlightenment? To what category would it belong? Who could possibly own awareness? So you see, when we sit back and we see things as they really are, we see things as a vast non-dual expanse. And within that vast non-dual expanse, we see the reality of human life as dependent on that vast awareness rather than awareness being dependent on the body. So from cause and effect, we say awareness is dependent on my living as a human body. From the place of natural rest, we see that the body is dependent on awareness. This is an enormous distinction. It's really an enormous distinction. Because when we're sitting back, then, natural rest, and we're sitting back no matter what we're doing, so we can be running, studying, working, we're always at natural rest. Then we draw on the capacities and the enormous potency of vast body, speech, and mind, rather than taking ourselves to be totally limited in all those respects. We see things in a much different way, and we come up with solutions, practical solutions, to living in any realm that are just beyond anything that can ever come out of time and space or cause and effect. This is very important for us to know about ourselves as human beings, especially right now. To continue to take ourselves to be alternating suffering and happiness, bound by cause and effect, bound by time and space, where there's a seeker seeking something that's off in the future, a seeker who's trying to impose all kinds of causes that will lead to the effect of enlightenment. I'm sure you can just hear in my speaking that even when I start to speak those words, it feels uncomfortable. Feels uncomfortable to even think about seeking. It's like saying, well, I think I'll go out and seek my arm today and prove that it prove that it exists. I'm going to ask everyone who sees me if I have an arm, and some of them will say, especially in India, yes you do, and others will say, no you don't. But I'm going to prove that I have an arm. And no matter what anyone says to me, I still won't believe it. I won't believe that I either have an arm or I don't. So you see, this isn't something we can get from anybody, because we already are what we are. We already are what we are. We don't have to do anything to prove it. The ease of our being, which is our natural state, is the evidence of what we are. That's the full evidence of our already accomplished enlightenment. Questions?
I have a question about the heart. For me, the epitome of my experience as a human being has been when I've been feeling my heart, and I've only been able to feel it consistently in one or two circumstances, like peace dancing or when I was with my lover. How does this relate to awareness and compassion, particularly?
I'll share a story with you. This story was told by Wangdor Rinpoche, told by me to Wangdor Rinpoche. And this is a great story. He said, you know, in Tibet, where I'm from, it's very, very cold most of the time, and the elevation is 15,000 feet. That's very high. Not many people live at 15,000 feet. And he said, when somebody dies, we can't bury him in the ground because it's too hard, you know, there are too many rocks. We can't dig a hole. So what we do is we take him up to a nearby hillside or mountaintop. We put the corpse up there, Naropa, the corpse, and then the buzzards come and they eat the entire corpse until everything's gone, until it's completely gone. And he said, you know, in the West, everybody talks about the mind, and in Tibet we talk about the heart. But he said, the buzzard doesn't care. Whatever we take something to be, that's what it is. So if we take something to be related to enlightenment, then we'll take that thing to be related to enlightenment, and we'll constantly have to try to hold it in place in some way. Well, all we're trying to do is hold pure space in place. Do you see? There's no one. The one trying to hold pure space in place is also pure space. So it's like pure space trying to hold pure space in place, and the holding is pure space too. So you see, it's much easier to just rest than to try to figure anything out. The more we try to figure everything out, the less ease there is, the less natural ease of our being. And oh my, there are so many ideas out there about this stuff, huh? So many ideas out there. There are endless ideas, especially in India. And now with the internet, that puts the ideas of India on the back burner. Now on the internet, we can have ideas from all over the world. This culture, that culture, cultures nobody ever heard about that have just been discovered. We can spend our entire life looking. But you see, this is very important, because the whole notion of being a seeker keeps a personal identity in place. The whole notion of being a seeker, seeking something, keeps a personal identity in place. And sometimes when all we've known about ourselves is being a personal identity, we really want to keep that in place because maybe we think that's what we are. So we've taken ourselves to be that. And outside that, there isn't much of a comfort zone. So when we see then ourselves as a seeker, we're still a somebody. We still have a personal identity that's seeking something. But the beauty of this teaching, the Great Freedom Teaching, is that there isn't a personal identity to get rid of. From the beginning, the personal identity is it's just a point of view equal to every other point of view. So all points of view, no matter what they are a single non-dual expanse of equalness and evenness that is entirely aware, that is completely inseparable from that awareness and also from compassion, that has an obvious natural presence but can't really be called anything. So, you know, the moment we start to call it something, which is what seeking's propensity is. The propensity of seeking is to make enlightenment into something that a personal identity can understand. And so if we say, okay, enlightenment is nothingness, then we'll constantly be trying to use that point of view or objective support to support our idea of what enlightenment is, or emptiness, or no self, or no thought, or utter lucidity, or even pure awareness, or bliss, or clarity. Because, you know, when we come totally into ease as the evidence of our being, and that's obvious at all times, then, you know, in one instant the description nothingness might appear, and the other it could be utter lucidity, and then there could be days with nothing at all, no thought at all. It isn't something. So you see, it isn't something, and it's not a destination. We already are who we are. We are not something, and the reality of our being is not something. And what we are, as we already are, it is not a destination. When we live within the realm of cause and effect, time and space, we live entirely within this realm of life, birth, and death. And we see everything, including ourselves, as being something that has an origin, or a somebody who has an origin, a duration, and a cessation. But when we rest naturally as the ease of our own being, more and more we see that origin, duration, and cessation, birth, life, and death, all these too are points of view. We enjoy the richness of the experience of all of them, but not as a personal identity. Not as a personal identity. Who is the sole focus, the crux, and the heart of everything that's going on. A self-centered identity is an identity in which body, speech, and mind are totally focused on a personal identity, on there being someone who has a personal identity. To be totally at ease, as we actually are, is to realize ourselves to be that which encompasses all. And that body, speech, and mind, rather than having all its thoughts, emotional states, and sensations being involved in the focus on a personal identity or self, that body, speech, and mind is encompassing of the totality. And as it is encompassing of the totality, it is that which is the benefit that is inherent in the totality. So the non-dual expanse itself is wholly positive, in that it has never been anything other than what it is. It's wholly positive. In that which is wholly positive and entirely non-dual, there has never been confusion. There has never been confusion because there has never been an unconfused state. Neither of those has ever existed as something. So see, for many of us as human beings, we spend our whole life trying to get out of confusion. Just trying to get out of confusion, the confusion of a personal identity, the confusion of someone with bodily suffering, mental suffering, and emotional suffering. We try to get out of that, try to get out of what we are, but we're inseparable from any of our perceptions. In natural rest, we can understand and come completely to terms with the inseparability of suffering and the total bliss, love, wisdom, and compassion of pure awareness. They're inseparable. But as long as we try to diminish the suffering, quell it, quash it, all we'll do is neutralize it. We can neutralize the suffering and kind of dull its impact. But there's still two. Do you see what I mean? There's the suffering and awareness. But when we rest naturally, and as all of our points of view come up, no matter what they are, we realize that our points of view, no matter what they are, positive, negative, or neutral, that they're inseparable from this awareness, then we expose ourselves to a whole new reality about ourselves. Our personal identity doesn't become so fixed within time and space and cause and effect. More and more we realize that this personal identity that we can enjoy for a while, we enjoy as awareness. It is because awareness is. So our natural presence is because awareness is. We wouldn't even be aware of being naturally present without that awareness. So this is key. This is really key. We are a great reality beyond our wildest imagining. And the less we put in the way of that, in terms of ideas, concepts, labels, things we need to do, the more obvious it is. Because you see, this isn't really a reality that can be categorized as anything. We can't say it's the spiritual dimension of being or the religious dimension of being. We certainly can say that. But if we limit it to spirituality or religion, then we've taken it out of being a lived reality for many, many human beings, because there are many human beings who have no interest in religion or spirituality, more and more. And then if we just put it in the category of philosophy or science, in each of those categories, there are many people who would have no interest. However, if we say, well, awareness is common to all human beings, then suddenly there are 7 billion people who have an interest in that, because there are 7 billion people who know they're aware. We all know we're aware. We wouldn't even be aware of being right here if there were an awareness as the primary reality of that. So it's important that we be able to simplify the reality of what we are and communicate it directly to each other in a very simple and straightforward way. that can include any category, spirituality, religion, philosophy. All these things are enjoyable parts of life. We're not trying to get rid of anything. It's just that in a very common way, we come to a complete as well as open understanding about who we are as human beings that we can then do with whatever we want. You know, we can be a philosopher, we can be a mathematician, a scientist, a swami, or, you know, whatever it is. Teacher, mother, plumber, electrician, whatever. Selling vegetables from our vegetable cart. Who we are doesn't have limitations in terms of careers. It's not limited by anything. But when we come to a common understanding about who we are as human beings, it's urgently important because it unites all of us. You know, it unites all of us. We can say in a simple way, well, we're all aware, and that awareness that we are, that it is the ease of our being. It's the complete ease of our being. It's the naturalness of who we are as human beings. And when we realize that about ourselves as human beings, we realize an immensity of power and force to live life and provide solutions not only to our own human existence, but to those that of our family, our community, and world. We realize solutions. We come in touch with solutions that can never occur otherwise, because there are many solutions that can't possibly occur within time and space, cause and effect. Many solutions. We see very little evidence of this right now in human life, but we will see a lot more of it as more people realize that we're not limited by who we've taken ourselves to be. You see, we can't learn our way into who we really are, because who we really are is the realm of no more learning. It includes and contains everything, so all learning already is contained within it. It is beyond learning, yet includes all learning. So you see, within the realm of cause and effect, time and space, we're limited to solutions that are based on learning. Based on there being an observer who observes something and then causes some kind of an effect on that thing.
Will we be able to recognize solutions which have come not about from cause and effect? Or to recognize those kinds of solutions, will we have to be quite aware ourselves?
Not at all, because see, what we are is already accomplished. So there are solutions that come at random from beyond cause and effect all the time, just like Heisenberg's theory, or some of the new theories, the string theory, or Einstein's theories, some of which are quite outmoded now. But Einstein was very familiar with his discoveries coming from something that was totally beyond anything he had ever learned. It was part of him. He didn't know how to make that fully evident in his life at all times, but he was very acquainted with it, and he found that many of his discoveries came to him in dreams or in a dreamlike reverie. But that dreamlike reverie, it was just awareness of a non-conceptual state. So he'd be aware of a non-conceptual state in which nothing was going on. There was no learning at all, nothing from the past that he had learned about physics, and nothing that he could remember even from a minute ago. And then suddenly, E equals MC squared. Well, you know, no one else had thought of that. It couldn't come about from within cause and effect. So at random, there are all kinds of things that occur. And, you know, we see this, especially in yogic cultures like the Tibetan culture and the Indian culture, where there are people who are able to manifest certain things or employ certain kinds of magical feats. like producing something out of thin air. Ravi has a ring that Sai Baba manifested for him. Ravi's asleep right now, but that's okay. He's totally at ease. So you see, all of these things, there are random occurrences, or even for some yogis, these things can be controlled, so things can be manifested, but yet the yogi isn't enlightened, so to speak. They're not the reality of what is always beyond cause and effect. So there's been a book written recently about yogic feats and of different kinds, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama is one of the authors of the book, so it's not a it's a very important effort, and it's a tantra that he's wanted translated for a very long time into English, because of course it is available in Tibetan. And he couldn't find a translator who would translate it. For 20 years he's been trying to get Jeffrey Hopkins to translate this tantra, but Jeffrey Hopkins felt he wasn't capable of translating it, because you see, to translate something like that requires also not only the ability to be able to translate something from Tibetan into English, but also the realization that goes along with what he's going to be writing about. And so when he was exploring this matter and visiting a number of great yogis that His Holiness the Dalai Lama had brought together up in Dharamsala to be interviewed, what he found was that the greatest yogic powers were two. One is liberation. So of all the powers, the power to liberate others, in other words, to confer the direct initiation or introduction to emptiness or awareness, and then to bring the full evidence of that into being, that is the greatest yogic power. And along with that, knowledge of all sacred treatises. So he said of everything he saw, what was most impressive to him was someone who had knowledge of all sacred treatises. In other words, without any learning, going to school, going to any of the Tibetan colleges or monasteries, and learning about the sacred treatises, the yogi could just pick up everything and knew everything about it. So you see, we know very little about these things as human beings, but it's important for us to get acquainted, because it's really the only way we'll be around. And it's certainly the only way we can come to terms with the problems facing humankind. But you see, there's a tendency to see all these problems, and then sometimes when it comes to spiritual practice, non-existence looks like a great option. Non-existence, nothingness, no self, those look like great options, because then we don't have to take responsibility for anything going on. We don't have to take responsibility for the contents of our own body, mind, and makeup. We don't have to take responsibility for our family, community, and world. So all we do really is adopt an extreme. It's an anomaly of point of view, but it's still within point of view. Nothingness, non-existence, no self, no thought, non-conceptual states, all these are anomalies of point of view. They're not the conventional points of view, but they're still points of view. It may give us great relief to just have the experience of emptiness all the time, or the experience of no self, or whatever it is, but these are states. They're not the reality of total being. The reality of total being is not a state, and it has no description. So, you know, the moment we say, okay, it's emptiness, it's non-existence, and I'm going to prove that to myself every minute, and I'm going to stay in that state no matter what. In fact, there's not even going to be an I staying in that state. There's just going to be the state. All of that is just a concoction of point of view. It's all more point of view. It may bring tremendous relief, but it's still point of view. When we have this natural rest of emptiness as the reality of our being, when we have the direct experience of that that's obvious at all times, it doesn't mean we're in a state of emptiness. It means we're the reality of emptiness, empty awareness that is naturally present and entirely responsive. These three are inseparable. Empty awareness, its natural presence, and compassion. They're completely inseparable. The three fundamental expressions of omniscient, timeless awareness.
You may answer this with a little story about buzzards, but it's kind of like the flip side to the lens question.
Mm-hmm.
We've been through 12, 13 days of teaching, and this teaching seems to have come through something, my mind, my heart, whatever. But is it necessary for it to be filtered through the mind, say, in order to see it? It's kind of the idea of the teacher, it's a duality of teacher and student. But.
Well, when we adopt a teaching or a spiritual practice, then for many of us, it seems like there's someone doing something. There's someone who's doing a teaching, and then there's the teacher teaching it. And there's a someone who has taken himself to be a body with a mind and a heart. And so it's that body, mind, and heart that are doing this teaching and being taught by the teacher. So you see, the more that we really understand the nature of our points of view, the more the grip on that lessens. You know, it isn't so necessary to see ourselves as boxed in to some kind of limited idea of what our body, speech, and mind is. And for some of people, you can see this comes about quickly, and for others more slowly, but it doesn't matter how it comes about. Don't ever compare yourself to anyone else. If you want to compare yourself to someone, compare yourself to yourself. You know, do you have more of the ease of being today than you had yesterday? That's all you need to know. When it comes to teachings of non-duality, especially these days, there are many talks you can go to like this. But and in all of these talks, it is stated, well, you have to give up all your belief systems and assumptions. Just be who you are. That's the message. Just be who you are and give up all your belief systems and assumptions. Well, there's motivation to end suffering in that. In other words, to end the suffering of taking ourselves to be somebody in particular. And there's great desire and longing to be what we are. You know, we all want the relief of that. But there's really no way to clear away the fog, to clear away the fog of having lived for decades within the realm of time and space, cause and effect. There are so many points of view, and also we take ourselves to be an accumulation of all these points of view. That's part of our identity, that we're the accumulation of everything we've ever thought, all our emotional states, all of our actions. So it's like living in the middle of a haze, of a fog, of a cloud bank, and we can't really see outside it. And then we're told to get rid of all of our belief systems and assumptions, that they have to go. Well, the belief systems and assumptions, they are the fog bank, and we're the fog too, you know? It's all one thing. We can't really find our way out of it. So what the 12 Inquiries teaching does is it identifies those belief systems and assumptions that have caused so much suffering in a very clear and specific way, and not as a general philosophical overlay or band-aid to put on something, but you had to look clearly at your own life, exactly how all of the points of view and taking yourself to be all those points of view have caused you suffering. So taking yourself to be a body, taking yourself to be a mind, taking yourself to be limited by time and space, cause and effect, how that has caused you suffering, caused suffering in your relationships, and how based on that you built all kinds of belief systems and assumptions related to that. So you see, this is a key distinction between just having a satsang where you're told be who you are and where you're given a written teaching where you directly look into that so relentlessly that you can't hold on to it any longer. And it isn't just looking into that relentlessly, but at the same time, it's always posited or positioned as inseparable from awareness. So all the points of view and belief systems that are being looked at are shown to be, are demonstrated as awareness. So they're not something that's being examined. It's awareness as that point of view, awareness as that belief system, awareness as that assumption. This is it's very natural. It's so natural. It's exactly how we learned to be little me. We learn to be little me by constant repetition. Somebody's over our crib. You're Chris. You're Chris. You're Chris. And I'm going to prove it to you. You're Chris, and you're a little boy. Little boys do this, and little boys have these kinds of toys. And little boys, when they grow up, they become men, and then they do this. So, over and over and over again, through repetition and hearing this, reading about it, learning to write about it, through all this repetition of all these different modes of sensory experience, Chris takes himself to be whoever he is. And when that's looked into clearly, and it's looked into as being in, of, as, and through awareness that all these points of view are, they're only the dynamic energy of awareness, nothing else. They're completely inseparable from awareness. All form, speech, and mind of everything is what Chris is, rather than just being limited to some singular idea of Chris as a human being, limited by time and space, cause and effect. So just as gradually over time we take ourselves to be a fixed identity, for most people, gradually over time, we realize we're timeless. And when we realize we're timeless, that's timeless. When we realize we're timeless, we realize all along when we've taken ourselves to not be timeless, we are timeless. We've been timeless all along. We're timeless now, and we always will be. This is the reality, the great reality of awakened awareness that is always so, that is naturally present. Something more about that, Chris?
Just that I feel the buzzards.
You feel the buzzards picking at you? With their warm, fuzzy beaks.
Yes. So, you say self-destruct is like property, said. But you still, there should be some sadhana to quiet the mind.
There's no mind to quiet. There's no mind to quiet. If we spend our lifetime trying to quiet the mind, it's very likely we'll spend our entire lifetime trying to quiet the mind. What the mind is because of awareness. So the mind is only awareness. If we take ourselves as somebody who has a mind and limit ourselves to that and think that we have that that's the cause of our not being enlightened and that we have to calm it down somehow, then we'll spend our whole life doing that. So the reality of what Papaji said is be here, be right here. What already is, already is. Empty, aware, basic space. That's the reality of everything that is, with nothing going on. Papaji said nothing ever happened. And ultimately, nothing did ever happen. There's the reality of awareness as everything. So there's no mind to calm down. there is awareness as a mind that's always active. You know, awareness is the mind that is itself. So as awareness is a vast expanse of infinite space, mind too is a vast expanse of infinite space, and so is body and speech, and all those are inseparable. So there, as long as we're trying to do something to be that, we can't be that. We have to come to a complete stop, just as the natural ease of our being. And in that natural ease of our being, we're like space. If we take up a practice, for example, like one-pointed calm abiding, then we'll be putting all of our efforts into abiding calmly in a one-pointed fashion. And that can go on for a long time. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with one-pointed calm abiding. As long as we know that the reality of one-pointed calm abiding is awareness. In other words, one-pointed calm abiding as a state is not something we want. We only know one-pointed calm abiding is because of the awareness that is primary as it. So it's always the awareness that we rest as. And then we can be doing anything. So you see, if we wanted to call that a sadhana, we could, I guess. But it would be like the ultimate sadhana or the practice, because it's the sadhana that's already free. It's the sadhana that's already free as each perception. No perception would be without awareness, and the awareness of it is as it. It's the sadhana in which there is no perceiver perceived from the very beginning. When we're introduced to some kind of a state like emptiness, and then we need to persist in that state, or coming to a complete stop, and then we need to persist in that state, then there might be a perception that comes up somewhere that we can't deal with. You know, we may not have had the instruction that, well, really what this emptiness is the emptiness of every perception. It doesn't matter what it is. So these days we all hear many stories about that, people who have had profound experiences of emptiness and entered into a state of emptiness for a long period of time or some other state. And then all of a sudden something happens. You know, maybe they've even become gurus in the meantime or teachers. And then all of a sudden something happens. There are repressed memories from childhood or something like that that come up, of something awful that happened, or there's a catastrophic illness, or just other contents of awareness that come up and swoop, the point of view net comes down, and then the state isn't there anymore. Because see, a state is a point of view too. So this is very important. When there's a direct introduction to emptiness, it's very important that that direct introduction have follow up. And traditionally, it's always been that way. When people realize the reality of what they are, those giving them instruction are available then to support them if anything comes up. Because it's been known throughout time, throughout all of human time, that this can happen. You know, there can be a profound introduction to the great reality of what we are. But we still need to have had the instruction that introduction to the reality of what we are is freedom as every perception. It's freedom as every perception, no matter what the perception is, and including the perception of our own death. We're free as all perceptions, whether it's horrors of childhood that come up that were totally repressed. That's empty of an independent origin, as empty of an independent origin as anything else. It's all equal, a non-dual expanse of equalness and evenness. But unless we have, an affiliation of some kind with a teacher or at least a good friend who has integrated all perceptions, positive, negative, and neutral, then if the person hasn't integrated negative perceptions, they can't possibly support us with that. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Whatever happens here is very strong.
The words I say have little to do with what's going on here. It's all, it's an alphabet made of pure space, you see. We'll sit quietly for a few minutes.